Tonight I'd like to speak on the subject of the ministry of Elijah and Elisha. And I want to do something a little different from what we might normally do when we consider those two men. If you could find your way to 1 Kings chapter 16, that's where we'll pick up the story. So often we look at Elijah and Elisha and other characters in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and all we do is look at the individual stories and treat them more or less as separate Sunday school lessons, good stories with an application. Now, I'm not saying that we can't do that, but what I am saying is that I'd like to find out what was the overall purpose of the ministry of Elijah and Elisha. And we're going to look at quite a large expanse of 1 Kings and 2 Kings. Now, just to fill in some details here, the ancient nation Israel had split in two following the death of Solomon. The southern part consisted now of only two tribes. It called itself Judah. The capital of the southern kingdom was still Jerusalem, and it carried on the Davidic dynasty, Rehoboam and other kings following. The northern part of this divided kingdom consisted of 10 tribes. It called itself Israel, but it consisted of many different dynasties, some of them very, very short indeed, as there was a lot of rebellion and coups and counter-coups and the like. Finally, a man emerges by the name of Omri, and Omri established the strongest dynasty to that time. He transferred the capital from where it previously was to Samaria, and Samaria then remained the capital of the northern kingdom until the northern kingdom came to an end sometime later. Now, that's talked about in chapter 16 of 1 Kings, verse 23. It mentions Omri there as now the king over Israel. Verse 24, he bought the hill of Samaria, he fortified it, and he made it his capital. Omri established this strong dynasty. He was an evil man, as it says in verse 25. He didn't follow the Lord. But he is best known for his son, Ahab. Because when Ahab came on the scene, Ahab married a woman called Jezebel. And between the two of them, they then introduced into Israel a form of religion which threatened the very existence of God's people. Now, let me just talk a little bit about this religion. The people of Israel, ever since they had come into the land way back in the time of Joshua, had been troubled by Baalism, Baal worship, that is, worshipping the local Canaanite Baals. These were gods of nature who were thought to have power to influence the weather, influence fertility, and give them growth in their crops and herds and families. And the people of Israel had combined this Canaanite nature worship with their own worship of Jehovah, who they saw, of course, as the god of nature. Their worship of Jehovah was really a corruption because it had all these elements of Baalism mixed in. And so the local Baal worship was, you might say, a corruption of the true Jehovah worship. And we find it is denounced right through Judges and Samuel and into the book of Kings. And Rehoboam in the north had established his own gods when he broke away from the son of Solomon. And again, this was a combination of Baal worship with Jehovah worship. When we come to Ahab and Jezebel, we find again Baal worship, but this is a far more serious form of Baal worship. And it's to deal with this more serious form of Baal worship that Elijah and Elisha are concerned. Ahab married Jezebel, who was the daughter of the king priest of Phoenicia. Phoenicia, the area just north of Israel, Tyre, Sidon, Zarephath, they are the cities of Phoenicia, modern-day Lebanon, if you like. The king of Phoenicia, Ethbaal, was a king priest. He was the custodian of this evil form of Baal worship. Melkart, the great god, was housed there in Phoenicia. And Ethbaal, the king of the Sidonians, was the official priest-king and custodian of this religion. Now, his daughter Jezebel was a fanatical follower of Baal. She married Ahab, the king of Israel, and now she sought to establish Baal worship as the official state religion of Israel. So this is a much more serious issue than the local Baal worship. Now that was bad enough, all this corruption through local idolatrous ideas. That was bad enough. It had been there a long time in Israel. But this now threatened to completely replace any form of Jehovah worship, even corrupt form. It was going to replace that with a totally new religion imported from outside, this Phoenician Baal worship. I'm going to call it Jezebel's Baalism, just to distinguish it from the more traditional, rustic form of Baalism that existed around the countryside. Now notice what happened here in chapter 16. Verse 29 tells us Ahab becomes king. Verse 31 tells us that he took to wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. He went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. Notice what's happening. Just as Solomon built a house for Jehovah in Jerusalem, so now Ahab builds a house for Baal in Samaria. Jehovah is the God of Judah, and his temple is in the capital. Baal is now the God of Israel, and his temple is in the capital, Samaria. We find now that God is going to raise up these two men, Elijah and Elisha, to rescue Israel. It's only the second time in the history of Israel that you're going to find such a collection of miracles. The other great collection of miracles is back in the time of Moses, when the existence of the nation was threatened. At the outset of Israel's history, they were slaves in Egypt, and God had to work many miracles to rescue that nation and preserve it as a nation right in its very infancy. Now, a second time, this time the religion of the nation is threatened with extinction, and again God works miracles on an unusually large scale. The miracles through Elijah and Elisha are twofold. Their purpose is twofold. One, to preserve the remnant. That is, to preserve the minority of faithful believers that still were there. It is the job of Elijah and Elisha to find out these people, to strengthen them, to encourage them, so that they will carry on the true worship of Jehovah. And so that is the blessing side of their ministry. That is the positive side of their ministry, if I could put it that way. The preservation of the faithful remnant. And then you have what we might call the negative side, the cursing side, and that is bringing judgment upon the evil nation. Firstly, bringing judgment, or announcing judgment, or preparing the way for judgment upon the evil house of Ahab and Jezebel, and then more broadly upon the nation of Israel as a whole, because the nation had followed the way of Jezebel. Now notice how these various miracles work. We'll start in chapter 17. Now I'm not going to read every verse. I think you know these stories fairly well, so I'll just refer to them. We notice first of all in chapter 17 that God brings a drought upon the land to show that he, not Baal, is in control. Now the people said Baal is in control of the weather. Baal is the great god who determines whether it's going to rain or otherwise, and so they worshipped Baal. We find now that God makes it very clear that he is in control, and so he calls for a drought for 3 years. He is stronger than Baal. And yet at the same time, we know that God has power even over the drought, because he is able to preserve alive his messenger Elijah. The ravens feed Elijah. And so there from the beginning you have these two elements, the preservation of the remnant and the bringing of judgment. From there Elijah is sent north into Zarephath in verse 9. Zarephath belongs to Sidon and Tyre, to Phoenicia, the very home of Jezebel's Baalism. And even there, in the very heart of Baal's country, Baal is powerless. Powerless in the face of Jehovah. So what God is proving here is this, that he is more powerful than Baal, and Baal, even in his own home territory, is unable to resist the power of Jehovah. But once again, notice, God preserves his faithful. He preserves a widow who was there in Zarephath. And we know the story of how the jar of meal did not run out, the bowl of oil did not run out, and so she was kept alive. Also, she had a son who died, and Elijah gave her back her son. The widow's son was healed. Part of the faithful are preserved. At the end of chapter 17, where he says, your son now lives, the woman says, now I know that you're a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. Again, confirming the faith of the few faithful scattered here and there. Here we have this lady who lives in the very heart of Baal's region, and she again is strengthened through the work of Elijah. There's another interesting reference in chapter 18 concerning Obadiah in verse 4, one of the king's officials, and again you have this element of preservation. He preserves 100 prophets because Jezebel was out to kill them. This woman Jezebel had really set out on a campaign to obliterate the name of Jehovah from Israel, and Ahab was hand in glove with her. She had become very successful. And as you move through chapter 18 now, you come to verse 19, and you find that she has 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah, one of the female companions of Baal, one of the other gods associated with Baal. 850 full-time missionaries, if you like. And these, at the end of verse 19, eat at Jezebel's table. That is, they are maintained from the royal coffers. They get their wages from the king and queen. So this attempt to really make Jezebel's Baalism, the Phoenician Baalism, to make this the official religion of Israel, it seems to be succeeding. Incidentally, most of the story we're looking at, virtually the whole of this section, it's really one section from the beginning of chapter 17 right through to about 2 Kings 12, that whole section is, as the Americans would say, one of a piece. It's one complete unit. It's rather different from what precedes it and what follows it in the general style of the Book of Kings. It's one complete unit dealing with this whole era of the invasion of Phoenician Baalism into Israel and the ministry of Elijah and Elisha to resist it. Most of this section is concerned solely with the northern kingdom. The southern kingdom, Judah, hardly gets a look in. Well, just coming back now to where I left off there, chapter 18, Jezebel is apparently being quite successful, as she now has 850 full-time people working for her, spreading her religion throughout the country. And Elijah has the impression, in verse 22, that he alone is left of those who truly follow God. He then calls the prophets of Baal for a contest on Mount Carmel. Now, Mount Carmel was acknowledged by the Baal people as being a sacred mountain. One of their sacred hilltop sites, one of the great high places, was there on Mount Carmel. And we know the story very well, how that he challenged these people to get fire to come down from heaven to burn up the sacrifice. And we know that they were not successful. But then Elijah was successful. He defeated the prophets of Baal, and the defeat, notice this, the defeat involved lightning, wind, and rain. Lightning, which came down from heaven, fire came down from heaven and burnt up the sacrifice. And then at the end of chapter 18, there are great black clouds, there's wind and there's rain, and the drought is broken. Who broke the drought? Not Baal. Baal is powerless. God, Jehovah, is the God of nature. He breaks the drought. He made the drought in the first place. He breaks the drought in the end. He maintains his people through the drought. The elements of judgment and preservation. Now you might think, or Elijah anyway, he thought, that this surely would convince the people of the truth of Jehovah and of the falsehood of Baal. But we find the people aren't moved at all, or very few of them are. And poor old Elijah, he is rather downhearted. Jezebel is after his skin, and so he hotfoots it out of Israel, and he heads for Mount Sinai. And he comes in verse 11 of chapter 19 to Mount Sinai, which is there called the Mount of the Lord. In contrast to Carmel, which the Baal people considered their mountain, Elijah now goes to God's mountain, Mount Sinai. And there we have this well-known story of how he had a wind which rent the mountains, but God was not in the wind. Then an earthquake, but God was not in that. Then a fire, but God was not in that. And God is saying to Elijah, you thought that because of the wind and the fire and the earthquake and the rain and all these things, you thought that because of these violent and spectacular events, the people would believe. And they haven't. And God says to Elijah, these events may have some purpose, they may have some benefit, but it's not any real lasting benefit. And the only lasting benefit that's ever done in people's lives is as they have a deep inner conviction and respond to that inner voice of God, that still small voice, which is talked about in verse 12. The defeat on Mount Carmel had fire and wind and rain. Now again, Elijah at Mount Sinai sees the fire and the wind and the rain and the earthquake and other things. And God says, although these things may prove to some people, unless there is the work of God within, then there is going to be no lasting benefit. And that's something we must remember, because so often we meet people, there's been some national catastrophe or there's some catastrophe in a certain place, and people say, this will turn folks to God. And maybe sometimes it does happen, but we normally find that any drift towards God or fleeing towards God is rather short-lived. You may get one or two where it's permanent, but most people don't have any lasting change because of these violent and spectacular events. The same, you might have a hellfire preacher. He might preach such a scary sermon that people are frightened into the kingdom in huge numbers, or so it would seem. Some of them may be converted, but I think you'll find that most of them, the apparent conversion again, is short-lived. The spectacular events do have their place, but they normally don't bring any lasting change. And they didn't in the case of these people of Israel. They saw the spectacular events and the defeat of Baal, but many of them didn't change at all, because there was no response to that still small voice, that inner conviction. And that is the thing that really makes the difference between true conversion and a spurious conversion. This now brings us to chapter 19, verses 15 to 18, which is the key to the whole section. Elijah now has to go and anoint the executioners, as I call them, the three main people who are going to carry out God's judgment. Firstly, in verse 15, he's to anoint Hazael, king of Syria. Syria is to be used by God to attack Israel and punish the wicked nation because it has departed from God. Secondly, verse 16, he is to anoint Jehu, and Jehu is going to be God's instrument to carry out his judgment, specifically on the house of Ahab and Jezebel. And then thirdly, he's to anoint Elisha. And Elisha is the one, of course, who's going to succeed him and carry on this ministry of preservation of the remnant and at the same time judgment on the unfaithful. But through all this, says God in verse 18, I will leave 7,000 in Israel who have not bowed to Baal. There are 7,000 faithful. Now that's a very small number in view of the total population of the country. And it's Elijah's ministry, and now Elisha's ministry to follow, to seek out these people, to build them up, to strengthen them, and to make sure that the worship of Jehovah, the true worship of Jehovah, is maintained by these faithful. So there's the ministry of encouragement and preservation, and at the same time there's the ministry of judgment, as these other two characters, Hazael and Jehu, are introduced to carry out God's punishment upon the wicked nation. Well, if you can flip over now to 2 Kings chapter 2, in the meantime, Ahab has died, and he's been succeeded by his son. One son died, and then another son had come to the throne. This second son who's come to the throne now is a man called Joram, we're going to meet directly. Jezebel, however, is still very much alive, and she is still the power behind the throne. Her ideas have now been passed on through her son Joram, who is ruling, and so Baal worship is fairly firmly entrenched in the palace in Samaria. You find now, as you come to 2 Kings 2, that Elijah and Elisha move around among some of the schools of the prophets, helping to preserve these faithful people. Now, just a word about these schools of the prophets. If you go back to the time of Samuel, you'll remember that Samuel had trouble with some of these energetic and enthusiastic young men who, at times, rather went to excesses and brought considerable disrepute upon the name of prophets. But rather than just dismiss them out of hand because of their rather unusual behaviour at times, he sought to channel this enthusiasm and to make it a spiritual force for God and the nation. So he established schools of prophets in various places. And it's around these schools of the prophets that these men, Elijah and Elisha, go, seeking to strengthen these people. They weren't going to try to train professional prophets. In fact, you find later on that some of the writing prophets, the prophets whose writings are there in the Bible, some of them declared very plainly that they were not professional prophets because they apparently didn't want to be associated with some of the odd chaps that were to be found in some of those schools of the prophets. Be that as it may, there were certainly many of the faithful there in those schools of the prophets. And Elijah and Elisha moved around to strengthen those who still believed in Jehovah. There was a great temptation to stay there. You can imagine that Elisha would be tempted to stay at some of these schools, and this is understandable. It's a much easier job, you might say. It's a more pleasant job to be able to work among enthusiastic people who want to follow God. It's a more appealing work than working outside among some of these hardened characters, bashing your head against a brick wall, as it would seem at times. And no doubt the temptation was there for Elisha to remain at one of these schools and to help to teach these people. And it would have been a good job to do. Somebody's got to do it, and it's a worthwhile job. But Elisha's call had been to something more than that. He had been called to follow Elijah, and it was going to be a ministry out there in the hard, cold world, moving around many people, strengthening many and helping many, and at the same time bringing God's judgment upon the leaders of the nation and upon the people as a whole. So we find then that as they moved around these schools, Elisha stuck closely behind Elijah. In chapter 2, for example, they came in the first verse to the school at Gilgal. But at the end of verse 2, Elisha says, "I will not leave you." And so they went down to Bethel to another school of the prophets. Again, when they came to leave Bethel, he says, "I will not leave you," at the end of verse 4. And so they went on to Jericho. Once again at Jericho, a school of the prophets. And at the end of verse 6, "I will not leave you." And so they went on. Because he wanted to remain with Elijah right till the end, so that Elijah's mantle would fall upon him. He would then receive the double portion of Elijah's spirit, meaning not that he was twice as good as Elijah, but that he was the legitimate heir. The heir received a double portion of the inheritance, that is, double everybody else. And he received his double portion, meaning, of course, that he was Elijah's heir, and so Elisha now carries on the ministry of Elijah. Well, as you look at the story as it moves on, you find once again these two elements of preservation and judgment. Now, I'll just remind you of the stories. I'm sure you know them well. Firstly, there was a poor widow in chapter 4. Her husband was dead, and her two sons were about to be taken in payment of a debt. We find now that there is provision given of oil. She sells the oil, pays off the debt, and so the woman and her two sons are preserved. That was a poor woman. And the next story concerns a wealthy woman. God has use for both the poor and the wealthy. And in this case, the husband was old, and the woman had no son. It was important that there be a son who could be an heir and so inherit the family property and at least maintain some substance among the faithful. Somebody needed property somewhere, and it was just as important to have wealthy people as to have poor people among the faithful. Elisha prays to God, and the woman is given a son. And then later on, the son dies. So Elisha brings him back to life. The faithful are preserved. The inheritance is kept. God again is looking after his people. And there's an interesting sequel to that story later on in chapter 8, where the woman lost her land during a famine. She went away, and during her absence somebody else must have got hold of it. But through a remarkable set of circumstances that illustrate the overruling of God, the woman received her land back. Later on in the chapter, this well-known story of the boys at the school of the prophets, how one of their meals was spoiled. Now, this strikes us as being a fairly trivial sort of a miracle. You say, fancy putting a miracle in the Bible, and all it's concerned with is saving a bowl of stew. But it demonstrates the dire poverty of these people. Here we had these young men at the school of the prophets. Apparently they had no cash to grow their own food, and they were reduced to going out into the bush, picking whatever they could and cooking it. And remember, of course, they were only Bible school students after all. Some of them weren't terribly cluey when it came to bushcraft, and one of them, by mistake, picked something that was poisonous. So when the meal was cooked, somebody else noticed that there was a plant in there that was poisonous. So the whole meal would have been lost. Elisha works a miracle to save the meal. You might say, well, what a paltry sort of a story. But it illustrates what straits these people were in. Perhaps they only had one meal a day, or one meal every 2 days, for all we know, and it was very important that that meal be kept for them. And then at the end of the chapter, another story, some sort of Old Testament parallel to the feeding of the 5,000 with the 5 loaves and 2 fishes. A farmer comes along, he has a certain limited amount of food, but miraculously it is multiplied to feed 100 of the faithful. And so we've got 100 here, a school of prophets there, a couple somewhere else, somebody somewhere else, a woman and her family somewhere else. And the 7,000 scattered all over the place, we find that Elisha is moving around to strengthen the faithful. In chapter 5, there are believers outside Israel. Naaman the Syrian, his faith may be not terribly robust, but at least it's better than most of the Israelites. And there's another twist in that story. The element of judgment is also there because God is preserving the commander-in-chief of the army that he is going to use to punish Israel, because Naaman was the commander-in-chief of the Syrian army. There's another story in chapter 6 of how the axe head swam. Now again, you read that and you think, what a trifling story to have in the Bible. If you're going to do miracles, you should do big miracles. Why do miracles for little things such as making an axe swim? But again, it demonstrates the poverty and the needs of these people. Their accommodation was no good. They had to rebuild. They had to go into the bush to chop down trees. They didn't even have the tools to do the job. They had to borrow the tools. And just to rub salt in the wound, those who were not wealthy enough to afford an axe in the first place now, of course, had to go and buy one and give it away to somebody else to replace the one they had lost. That really would have been hard to take. And so we find that Elisha rescues the axe for them. And then we come also to these elements of judgment. And the first story we have concerns the Syrians who were fighting against Israel. But unfortunately for them, the ambushes were always discovered because Elisha had these clairvoyant powers. And so they decided they'd capture Elisha. But when they went to capture Elisha, we find that Elisha zapped them, and they all were struck with blindness. And Elisha then led them off by the nose, so to speak, and they finished up right in the middle of Samaria. And then he opened their eyes, and when they looked around, there they were in the middle of Samaria. And of course, the Israelite king said, "Ha ha, let's kill them." That's what he says in verse 21 of chapter 6. "Let's kill them." And Elisha says, "No, don't kill them. Give them bread and water and send them away." That's an interesting illustration there of what I call circumstantial guidance. A lot of people are swayed by circumstantial guidance, by which we mean these circumstances are such that it clearly indicates I should do this. And all I say is go very carefully, because circumstances can be interpreted just about in any way we like. It may be that circumstances indicate that God wants you to go this way. It may be that the circumstances present a temptation to turn you away from the path on which you should go. We must be very careful the way we interpret circumstances. Too many people have simply followed and said, "Oh, it was obvious the Lord had arranged things that way, and that was the way the Lord led." And then they use that to justify something wrong which they have done. It's not a sign of faith to allow circumstances to push us round. We must decide what we're going to do, and sometimes we'll find the circumstances are favourable, and sometimes we'll find they are unfavourable. But we should not simply be weak and follow circumstances too easily. Too often that can mean taking the line of least resistance. They can always be interpreted in two ways, as they were here, as they were in the time of David. Remember when David came upon Saul, he could have killed him. And one of his henchmen said, "Kill him." He says, "The Lord has obviously given him into your hand." Circumstantial guidance. And David said, "I shall not lift my hand against the Lord's anointed." Circumstances in that case presented a temptation to David. And if he had have followed what one of his friends said was circumstantial guidance, in the process he would have broken God's law. And here again, circumstances, the very same set of circumstances, interpreted in two ways. One person says, "Ha ha, God has given these people into our hands, circumstantial guidance, let us kill them." Elisha says, "Circumstantial guidance, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him drink." Incidentally, what's the point of the story? Well, it tells us that God is in control. It's a lesson to the Israelites that God is in control and he is threatening them with judgment. Only if they turn to the Lord will they be saved from it. And it's telling the Syrians that God is using them to punish Israel, but they must remember that they are still within his control. The overall control of God, that is the message. And it's the same message in the next miracle, which concerns the siege of Samaria, when the lepers went out and they got the message that tomorrow there's going to be much food available. And so the starvation was relieved. Again, God is telling the Israelites, he is threatening them with judgment and says, the judgment can be averted through my grace if you turn to me. And saying to the Syrians, "Yes, I can bring you against my people, but remember, you are my instrument. and I can turn you away if I wish. We come over then to chapter 8, and the time has come when Elisha anoints Hazael to be king over Syria. Israel hasn't responded, therefore the judgment must follow. In chapter 8, verse 12, he weeps when he sees the evil that Hazael is going to do to Israel. And Hazael says, "Is your servant a dog that he should do such a thing?" And the answer, of course, is yes, he was a dog, and it's proved in verse 15 when he goes and smothers the former king and seizes the throne of Syria for himself. And now Hazael begins to attack Israel. At this point, we are told in chapter 8, verse 16, and this is an important point, that in the reign of Joram, the son of Ahab, Jehoram, the son of Joash, began to reign in Judah in the south. And it tells us in verse 18 that he married the daughter of Ahab. And just think for a moment what's happening here. The daughter of Ahab and Jezebel marries the king of Judah. The daughter's name is Athaliah. So Athaliah is the sister of the king of Israel. And she marries the king of Judah. And you find later on that the king of Judah reigns only a few years, and then he's succeeded by his son, a 22-year-old son called Ahaziah. But through Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, Jezebel's worship, Jezebel's Baalism, has now come into Judah. And so it's spreading. Elisha now realizes that the time has come for his last major responsibility, and that is to anoint Jehu. He's anointed Hazael to be king over Syria to carry out God's judgment on the nation Israel. Now he anoints Jehu to be king to carry out God's judgment on the house of Ahab and Jezebel in particular. Chapter 9, verse 1 tells us that Jehu was the commander of the Israelite forces who were out in Ramoth-Gilead, which is the frontier on the eastern boundary. That is the boundary with Syria. He was holding the fort against Syria. But then the prophet comes and anoints him. Elisha sends a prophet to anoint him king over Israel. In verse 11, Jehu's officers come out and they say, "Why did this mad fellow come to you?" You can see the scant regard or respect they have for prophets. What's this madman doing here? Another one of those crackpots. Jehu replies by saying, "Oh, you know that fellow and his talk. I mean, you know what those prophets are like. They're all a bit round the twist." And they say to him in verse 12, come on, that's not true. Tell us the true story. And he told them, "I'm king." And immediately all his officers nearly broke their arms, getting their shirts off to put them down on the ground, to do obeisance, to blow the trumpet and declare Jehu is king. And then Jehu really takes off to carry out his judgment. The first thing he does is to get in his chariot. He's the one who drove furiously, you'll remember, down across the Jordan, up and across into Jezreel. Now Jezreel was in the north of Israel. The Israelite king Joram was there at the time, and his nephew Ahaziah, the king of Judah, was visiting him. Well, that made it very easy for Jehu. First of all, he shot Joram and killed him. Ahaziah tried to escape, but he was killed after a short chase. And then the very grisly story of how Jezebel was killed. She met her death with royal dignity, but it didn't save her the inevitable execution. So that's the end of Jezebel. Ahab's already gone. The son Joram, he's gone. And the grandson Ahaziah, who's ruling in Judah, he's gone. Jehu now has the taste of blood. And so you find in chapter 10 that Ahab has 70 sons altogether, and Jehu then has a bloodbath and gets rid of those 70. He brings all the heads, it's a very grisly story this one, and he puts them in two heaps at the city gate. And then in the morning he comes out with a sort of mock innocence, trying to make out he didn't know how it all happened. Verse 9, he said, well, concerning the execution of Jezebel and Joram and these others, he says, "You're innocent." He said, "I was the one who struck down my master. I slew him. I take responsibility." But who struck down all these? I mean, how did it happen? I can't understand how they ever got here. Maybe an angel went out and did it in the night time. But I don't think the people were fooled, because Jehu, you see, was now using this mandate that he had to carry out God's judgment on the house of Ahab and Jezebel. You find he used that now as an excuse to strengthen his own power and to get rid of any potential rival. In verse 11, he not only kills those who remain of the house of Ahab and Jezebel, but he kills all the great men, all the administrators, all the friends, all the priests, anybody he can lay his hands on. In verse 12, he meets some of the relatives of Ahaziah. We don't know whether they were relatives on the mother's side, that is Jezebel's people, or relatives on the father's side, that is descendants of David. But it made no difference. He killed them all. He spared none, it says at the end of verse 14. Then in verse 15 you meet a chap called Jehonadab, who was the most anti-Baal of all the anti-Baal people you could meet. And he then gathered with Jehu all the people who worshipped Baal. Now they had a trick, and they said, "We also actually worship Baal, so come along and now we'll celebrate our great victory." And when they made sure that all the Baal worshippers were there, they then again called in their hatchet men and they slaughtered them. It was a terrible bloodbath. It's the old story of not knowing when to stop and using anything as an excuse to get your own way. It's amazing how once we have permission to do one little thing, we then are tempted to use that as an excuse to do whatever we want. And that's exactly what Jehu did. He carried the Reformation only as far as he wanted. Don't get the idea he was a great man of God. He certainly wiped out Jezebel's Baalism, and in verse 28, he is rewarded for that. Verse 30. But it says in verse 29, he did not turn aside from the local Baalism that had been there all the time, the sins of Jeroboam, the local gods, the Canaanite Baalism that had been there from the beginning. He still followed that. And now we find that the nation Israel is weak. All the leading administrators, we saw in verse 11, wiped out. And so the administration of the country is frightfully weak. The treaty in the north is in a shambles because he's just killed all the royal family from Phoenicia. So the treaty with Phoenicia to the north, that was broken. He's killed the Judean king, so any alliance with the south is broken. So Israel is now vulnerable on the north, it's vulnerable on the south. Internally, it's weak because of the bloodbath. And on the east, the Syrian frontier, well, of course, the army has deserted there because that's the army of Jehu. He was looking after the eastern frontier. And now the way is open for Syria to pour across the border, and that's exactly what happens in verse 32. Hazael now comes, and he begins this executioner's job of carrying out God's judgment upon the wicked nation. And so that really brings to a close the story of Elijah and Elisha, and it shows you how that they had been used to preserve the faithful remnant, to get rid of this Jezebel's Baalism, and then the story picks up and carries on in much the same strain as the story we're more familiar with in the books of Kings. But it shows the ministry of these men, that mixture of blessing and cursing, of preservation and judgment. Now just before I close, 1 minute, what happened in the south in Judah? I mentioned before that through Ahaziah, Jezebel's Baalism had come into Judah. Well, when Ahaziah was killed by Jehu, his mother, Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, seized the throne for herself in chapter 11, verse 1. And immediately she killed all her grandchildren. Lovely grandma, this one. She killed all her grandchildren and seized the throne. But in verse 2, we're told that one of them escaped. A small boy called Joash was rescued. He was kept safe for a number of years, and Jehoiada the priest, with various other priests and Levites and officials, organized a counter-rebellion, a coup d'etat, as we would say. And the upshot of it all was that Athaliah was killed, and that was the end of Jezebel's Baalism in Judah as well. And so chapter 11 and chapter 12 then tells us how the final traces of this Phoenician Baalism were rooted out even from Judah.